Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Terry McMillan is a best-selling author known for her novels that feature female African-American characters. Two of them, Waiting to Exhale and How Stella Got Her Groove Back, were made into major motion pictures. Her latest book is It's Not All Downhill From Here. Terry appeared at a virtual National Writer Series event, and she spoke with Detroit's Director of Arts and Culture, Rochelle Riley. Rochelle asked Terry to start out reading from her latest novel.
I don't want another surprise party, which is just one reason why a few weeks ago when my husband, Carl, called while I was walking our dog, B.B. King, to the dog park and asked what I wanted to do for my birthday this year, I politely said, baby, let's try to figure out how to get our second wind. At first, Carl high-pitched chuckled like he was a soprano or something, and then he said, well, we need a boat. I chuckled right back, even though I was serious as a heart attack. Don't you worry, Miss Lowe. I've got you covered, he said as he hung up. What I meant was, since we both had more days behind us than we had ahead of us, how about we try to figure out what more we can do to pump up the volume? It's not that our life is boring. Well, maybe it is a little. But even though we don't do very many things to generate excitement, I still love him more than my Twizzlers. Carl is a retired contractor who refuses to retire. And after 30 years of all work and no play selling hair and beauty products and two stores too many, I don't exactly qualify as a thrill a minute either. I released B.B. King's leash inside a dog park, but he just stood there shivering as if he were waiting to be invited to participate in some activity that didn't require him to run or jump. In human years, he and I will soon be the same age, 68. His whiskers and eyebrows are peppered with gray, but unlike me, B.B. doesn't dye his hair. He is our third German Shepherd, and I don't want to think about how long it will be until he doesn't want to or can't hop in the backseat of my Volvo station wagon, which I will drive until, like me, it stops running. I sat on the green metal bench and watched him sniff a friendly chocolate poodle. I realized I was hoping and praying I wasn't going to have to sit through yet another lackluster party where nobody even thinks about dancing until they hear a song you have to be damn near 70 to remember, which I suppose now includes me. And that's if you call doing the cha-cha-cha in flats or espadrilles or two-inch wedges with rubber soles to a beat they all hear differently dancing. I don't. I watch music videos on YouTube. I find myself rocking my future size 12 hips, swinging and swaying my shoulders and popping my fingers to the likes of Single Ladies or Uptown Funk by that little cutie Bruno Mars until I have to wipe my forehead. I have not forgotten how to dance. In fact, sometimes Carl will sit in his leather recliner, lean way back and just watch me swirl around in my 3-inch heels, which I wear to work every day because I like to appear glamorous. In those moments, I feel pretty and sexy and 40. Carl just nods his head like he's agreeing and pops his fingers until the smile on his luscious lips begins to disappear. Then he might hold up his index finger, suggesting that I give him a minute, but don't stop dancing, and slowly push himself up to a standing position and limp down the hallway to take one of his little blue pills. Oh, hell. Here I go again, meandering. I'm just gonna have to stop apologizing for it because from what I've learned reading my AARP newsletter, this is only the beginning. Though truth be told, forgetting what I was talking about and going off on tangents isn't completely new to me. Back in my 20s, I smoked a lot of reefer with my friends. We'd all sit in a circle on the floor on giant pillows and have deep conversations, but then we just all stopped talking because we were suddenly mesmerized by that lava lamp. Then somebody would realize they were one step away from freaking out and would jump to a standing position in order to snap out of it. And then they'd say, what the f*** were we just talking about again? And since not one of us had a clue, we just start passing the joint until the next philosophical inquiry overtook our minds. Thank God I got tired of thinking about things that didn't matter and realize I liked the way I felt when I wasn't under the influence of anything. And when I didn't like how I felt, it was a hell of a lot easier to figure out how to deal with it when my head was clear. Anyway, now I'm a certified senior citizen and my mind has earned the right to go wherever it wants.
This is why so many women, millions of women, read your books, because they see themselves, they see their friends, they hear the language. That's us. That's us, no matter who we are or where we are. It's been an amazing journey for you. You wrote Mama, your first book, your debut novel, 33 years ago. Ooh. I know. You look good, girl. So I want to talk a little bit about, now let's just talk about the fact that you got a journalism degree, and then you were teaching, and then you decided, I'm going to write this book. And if the publisher doesn't do all I want with it, I'm going to write all the bookstores around the country myself and have them sell it. What got you to the point where you decided, this is my life, this life that you have now?
Well, you know, I started writing poetry in college, very bad poetry. And then they just sort of, thanks to Ishmael Reed, I ended up taking a class at Berkeley, a fiction writing class. And then he said, girl, you know, you got a voice. And I was like, you know what? People always confuse me on the phone as a man. That's what I thought he meant. and then he ended up, of course, I figured out what he really was getting at. And he just told me, don't ever lose it. You know, don't try to imitate anybody else. Don't try to write like someone else. You know, own your voice. And that's what I learned how to tell my students to do. I used to have them write without putting their names on their stories. And then I would read them. And that's how I would help. I kind of try to help them find their voice. And sometimes I would have other people read their stories.
Could you tell who had written something without the name?
Once I got to know them, yes. Okay. Not initially. But that's true. A lot of writers now, I can pick up a book if I didn't know who it was. I mean, I just know certain writers, I can hear their voice and their style and their tone and all of that. And we all have it. You know, what's unfortunate is when people try to imitate other people.
You have not done that by any means. You literally have found, you didn't find a niche. You created a space for the voice that you have. And all of these women, all of these amazing, complicated women who find love and joy and pain and comedy, are any of them based on people you know? Is there a little bit of you in each of these books, or a little bit of your friends in every book and in this book, this new one?
You know, I might steal some things, maybe some idiosyncrasies or something like that, but no, I am not reenacting anybody's life. I mean, I do character profiles. And I use astrology, books, numerology, all kinds of stuff. Mostly, I used to use horoscopes.
Astrophysical stuff?
No, not astrophysical. I just tried to figure out what a Virgo or Libra. And I mean, I used to do charts. I know what a moon sign and this used to do. I mean, I used to do numerology, numeroscopes, all of it. So I have many ways to come up with characters. But sometimes it's the story itself that dictates the kind of characters. And I like to pit characters who have not so much against each other, but they love each other, care about each other, like each other, but there's always some kind of angst. There's something that rubs each other the wrong way, but not enough to stop loving each other and caring each other. We get on each other's nerves. I have friends like that now. But, you know, I've never gone any length of time without speaking to them. And, you know, sometimes we talk about each other to our faces.
Oh, yeah.
It's wonderful. But I've got friends I've had for 30, 40 years, you know, and fame and all that stuff does not change it.
I'm pushed to ask a question for young writers, not who want to be Terry McMillan, but who want to find their voice the way that you have. Can you talk a little bit about how you write, literally, like when you decide to start a book until it's finished?
I know that my character wants something that she can't have. And it could be a male character too. I've written one book from a male character's point of view. But usually, almost every character has something that's happening in their life that's causing them problems, that's making them unhappy, dissatisfied, bored, something. Something is wrong. Something is off kilter. And just like we are in real life, I mean, now we got the virus and you got people that can't pay their rent. They don't know if they're going to have to move. I mean, this is a big one, but some people have big ones. They didn't have to have a virus to feel like some of them are feeling. you know? And to me, my thing is I always tell young writers to write as if no one is ever going to read it first, because a lot of times people think that you write it first and it's perfect. It is not, it's never perfect. Every once in a while, my openings never change. That much I do know. But, you know, you don't write to show off. I believe that young writers or older writers who are just starting out need to write without thinking. And a character always is missing something, can't do something. Somebody is stopping them from doing something. And sometimes it's them. And there are a lot of things that we have to own up to. But a novel is an unsatisfied dream for me.
That makes perfect sense.
And I try to give create characters who, even if they're afraid to dig a little deeper or to make a left turn or climb another step, I put them in a position where they're going to have to do it anyway. Because otherwise, I call it literary masturbation. I don't have all day. You know, I want to tell a story and I want my character to go through something, because that's what happens to us. You know, all of us have had to change our lives because of this virus. I mean, a lot of things have changed. I'm so sick of myself being in this house by myself, I don't know what to do. You know, I slapped myself in the face yesterday.
Be careful.
Oh, God. But, you know, but I think more than anything for young writers, my thing is to don't try to imitate anybody else.
Yeah.
You know, I own my voice and I read all kinds of writers. And I love it when I can hear a character thinking when one character speaks, because I have a lot of characters in my book and I know what one of them is going to say. I know what she won't say. Some of them swear, some of them don't swear. Some of them, you know, I just know. And I know things about my characters that may never make it into the book, but that helps me. And sometimes I can tell too when I'm discriminating, because I have characters that I like more than others.
Who's your favorite? Ever?
Ever?
Yes.
I can't remember those people. I made them up.
Who's your favorite in this book?
Laretha's mother.
She is awesome.
She's a pistol.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I'm like her when I'm 86.
Talk a little bit about her. I know these aren't based on real people. These are characters. But did you get some of this from somewhere or see something? Where'd you steal some stuff from?
Now, I imagine what I would be like if I was in a nursing home. And, you know, she's a pistol. You know, she says what comes to her, whatever comes out of her mouth is what comes out of her mouth. And she's honest. She's very honest. She does not bite her tongue. And I love that about her. I hope I'm like her when I'm that old.
You will be.
It won't be long.
She's one of my favorites. So let's talk a little bit about film, because you did study film and you don't write the books to make them films. But when your third novel, Waiting to Exhale, exploded 3 million copies and it became that iconic movie. Tell me about that experience and whether that's something you want for the current book.
No, I don't think about, you know, first of all, Waiting to Exhale, that was like, you know, I mean, I couldn't even believe that. I couldn't believe how long the book was on the bestsellers list. And when somebody said they wanted to make a movie, I was like, are you serious? You know, but, you know, I took the money. I was excited. I couldn't believe it. But I write books to be read. I don't think about, oh, gee, could this be a movie? No. Mm-mm. No, I don't. But one of the things that you learn when you're writing is that people should see what it is you're writing.
Yeah.
You want to see it. It's like, it is like a movie on some levels, but you get to hear what people are thinking and you get to see what they see. You get to tell how they feel based on what they do, what they say, and what they don't say. An expression on somebody's face can tell you everything. But, now, I don't think about my books as movies. I write to be read.
I love books that when I read them, I can see the scene. So I want you to read a little piece for me, because I was there. And it's when she is stopped by a cop. And I've been stopped by the police before.
Well, have I
wasn't doing anything really wrong. well, maybe a little wrong, but I just imagined that whole scene and I could see myself in her shoes. So can you share that piece with our viewers?
This is Loretha.
Loretha.
Loretha. I was running late and decided to take the freeway 3X's to get to my hair appointment. When I heard a police siren and then saw red flashing lights behind me, I was just about to move to the side so that he could go around. But I realized it was me they were after. What did I do? I pulled over and stopped. I looked at my watch. I was now 15 minutes late, and Zenobia is usually late too. I was texting her to let her know what happened when I heard a tapping on the window. I rolled it down. License and registration, please. Officer, why did you pull me over? Because you were swerving. No, I wasn't. He glared at me, tall, pale, blue eyes, freckles, and bright red hair. All the signs of a redneck. You were swerving, ma'am. Please let me have your license and registration and keep your hands where I can see them. Oh, you think I have a gun or something? I should not have said that, but it should be obvious that I'm an innocent senior citizen, and he knew was not swerving. And what I am, and what I am and always will be, is black. But I reached inside a glove compartment and got the registration, then plopped my red Dooney and Bourke vinyl handbag in my lap, took my driver's license out of my wallet, and handed them both to him. Are you the owner of this vehicle? Yes. He looked at my registration, then at my license, then at me, and then at my license again. Who is this? It's me, officer. My name is on it, isn't it? This does not look like you. Let me see that. Keep your hands on the steering wheel, please. He lowered my license so I could see my picture. Damn. I have not bothered to get my picture changed in 10 years. I looked good and young, but I still looked like myself. That is me a few years ago. It's been longer than a few years. I suggest you update this photo and use your blinker when you're changing lanes. I always do, I said. He handed me back my documents and I snatched them. Have a good day, he said, without a drop of sincerity, and strutted back to his ugly police car, just like they do on TV shows. Go fuck yourself, I said after I rolled up the window. When I went to put my registration back inside the glove compartment, staring at me was a brand new package of Twizzlers. Without even thinking, I pulled them out, ripped them open, and bit off 2 or 3 inches of 2 stems at the same time. Then I dropped the entire package into my purse and pulled onto the freeway a little faster than I should have.
That is awesome. Now I can tell you, I identified with that because I know that I had a driver's license picture that was even the same hair color and was so old that if I'd been stopped, I would have had that happen to me. But there are these moments that you come up with like that, you know, where people are seeing themselves differently or people are recognizing where they are, whether it's your protagonist who is, you know, sort of understanding that they're in a different place or whether it's just, you know, again, a moment in time. These are the things that speak to people where they see themselves in your book. So how does it feel knowing that there are millions of people, a lot of them women, most of them women, but millions of people who are seeing you as the person who can bring them into that reality better than anybody else they know? I'm talking real fans.
I don't have millions of fans.
You do have millions of fans. Who do you think bought all those books? You have millions of fans.
I don't think so. But anyway, you know, I mean, I'm not trying to write about all African-American women, but a lot of us do have some things in common, you know, and especially depending on how we grew up, you know, and our parents and just our lifestyles. I mean, there's some things that we have in common, okay? And this Afro puff is one. No.
Yes, I had one until I cut it all off.
But, you know, there are certain things about us, like I said, the way we grew up, that are just common. We get it. And, you know, but the other thing is this, is I read books by a lot of white authors. And depending on how they portray the characters, I can identify with them. Not because I feel like the character, sometimes I do. And I don't stop and think, gee whiz, these white people, except when I'm read Ellen Foster back in the day. But no, I just think that's the beauty of all of us being able to write in our own voices. You know, when I read Gabriel Garcia Marquez, I know who he is. But there are certain writers I read specifically because of their voices. I love it when I can jump out of my own skin and heart and mind. And there are a lot of really fine writers out here, African-Americans included. I'm not trying to say, you know, I'm not even going there. But I read a lot of different ethnicities on purpose. But the bottom line is that we all are the same. It's always some kind of struggle. And sometimes it's based on your sex, your ethnicity, your sexual persuasion, all of it. We have familial issues, you know, sibling issues, job issues, whatever. But there's something that we want that we can't get. And like I said, and that's the beauty. But, you know, I don't write to depress anybody because I can be depressed all by myself. I don't want to read a book that's going to depress me unless you bring me back up a notch or two, because I can be depressed all by myself.
I'm telling you, and I don't read any of your books and leave feeling bad. It's like, if I'm going to feel bad, I can go read Revelations in the Bible, or I can go do something else.
Like a good movie, too.
And a good movie, too.
A lot of stuff happens in a movie, and you just think, I mean, for the most part, you know it's going to be somewhat of a happy ending, but not necessarily, you know, butterflies and all that. But it's just important to me to write realistic stories and put characters in realistic situations. And it's something that they want that they can't get. Sometimes they don't even know they want it. But that's true of a lot of us.
Every day. I was reading one report. There were several stories about who you are and your style. So they said that you caused a shift in Black popular cultural consciousness and increased the visibility of a female Black middle-class identity in popular culture. You used the word authentic a minute ago. So all of that other yang was just to say that you write authentically. You don't write characters to explain them to somebody who may not be like them or to make it easier for somebody to see them. You just write who they are. Is that something that is a part of activism, or again, is that just you writing real?
Well, I think, you know, I grew up financially deprived, I guess that's another way to put it, in a small town in Michigan, not far from Traverse City, Port Huron. And, you know, we were poor. Everybody was poor. White people were poor. And, you know, I just thought, you know, this is not very cool. I don't want to spend the rest of my life like this. And I used to listen. I mean, I went to Sunday school, I went to church and all that, but I knew that our world was different because we were Black. And I wanted to own my Blackness and not apologize for it and not try to run from it, because I never have and never will. But I wanted to excavate and see why it was that we were poor. And you know, why did we have to sometimes sneak to and steal to get a really good meal? You know, and why didn't more Black people go to college? You know, my mother told us when we were kids, every one of you little suckers are going to college, or, you know, I'm gonna drag you in there. And all of us pretty much did. Everybody didn't graduate, but we stepped foot in it. And there were just things that I just didn't understand why they were the way they were. And I still don't. There's still things that plague me and that baffle me. And that's one of the reasons why I write, because all of us, if we could, we just want to be happy. We want things to be smooth. And we want to feel beauty, and we want to feel beautiful. We just want, you know, all of it. And, you know, I think, you know, God gives us steps that we have to either jump over, walk around, or take or ballet our way up. I don't know. But there are a lot of challenges in our lives, and there's so many different stories that we can tell. I mean, I what I've always wanted to do is write the same story, but from a different character's point of view. Same exact thing. And I think there's a movie like that probably. I no doubt it, yeah, it is. Because Rashomon, and they used to do this, I saw once in law school, same thing, where, you know, 10 different people see the same accident. And they have to write it down. And everybody sees it differently. And that's one of the reasons why I like multiple viewpoint characters. But, you know, there's a lot of different ways to tell a story, and I hope I still have a few good years left.
Oh, gosh, yes. I want to go back to the beginning when we were talking about your first book 33 years ago, and you look back over 33 years and you see where you are now. Like when you finish a book, do you know, okay, I'm going to take a year and then I'll work on the next one, or when a character speaks to me? Like now that you have this one, do you ride this wave? Because this book is good and it's going to be, you know, out here for a while. You're going to be on the tour for a while. You'll be living with these characters for a while. When do you decide that it's time for something else?
I have 120 pages of a new book already.
Oh my God. Okay. We've got headlines. So what can
you do? No, it's not a headline. I worry about folks. That's what I do. And I write about characters that I worry about, that I want more for them, that I want better for them. And I'm not a magician. I don't write fantasies. Sometimes, I mean, I think Stella was a fantasy, mm-hmm. but it did happen to me.
Yep.
But not the way I wrote it. Because we deserve to fall in love with whomever we want to fall in love with.
That's okay. Right.
And plus things last as long as they last, but when it's good, it's good. And anyway, the book that I'm writing now, I don't want to talk about it, but the bottom line is I have 100 and some odd pages, and there's some folks in there that I am worried about.
Uh-oh.
I love them already.
Terry, I want to thank you so much, as always, for your characters, for the joy, and for the great, great work that you have given to all of your fans and to your fellow writers and to your fellow journalist wannabes.
I thank you all very, very much. And here's to us getting through this.
And don't forget, you have to come to Traverse City in person.
I will come to Traverse City. We better have some good food.
We will. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
That was Terry McMillan talking with Rochelle Riley, and you're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up in the second half, a discussion with author of legal thrillers, Scott Turow.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. In the second half of our program today, we'll hear a discussion with author Scott Turow. He's a lawyer and the author of the legal thrillers such as Presumed Innocent, which was made into a major motion picture starring Harrison Ford. His latest book is The Last Trial. The National Writer Series hosted a virtual event with Scott, talking with news director for TV station WPBN, Patrick Livingston. Patrick started out by asking Scott how the pandemic was affecting him and his work.
I do think that there will be wonderful creative works that come out of this period. As a writer, I have found myself unbelievably distracted by all of this. I find it very hard to concentrate, and I know, I have enough faith in my own process at this age that I know it'll work out eventually, but this is a time unlike any other time in all of our lives.
In your book, The Last Trial, Big Pharma plays a central role, the development and approval of a new product, the imaginary product Gelivia, as a cancer drug. With the research that you did on this book, what do you think is going on behind the scenes now, as we have so many companies, so many scientists around the world racing to try to find a cure and a vaccine for COVID-19?
You know, I have a high degree of confidence that a vaccine will be found. What is illustrated in the last trial, though, is some of the perils of rushing to market with a supposed wonder drug, because that's the circumstance in the last trial. And of course, it turns out that after a year of using this medication, some people literally dropped dead of an acute allergic reaction. And those are the risks if this vaccine is brought to market without adequate testing. We'll figure out as a society whether that's the right thing to do. In the last trial, it hasn't worked out very well for the developer of the medication, Sandy Stern's client, Kirill Pafko, who is accused of knowing that there were these lethal side effects, and accordingly is accused of fraud and insider trading and even murder.
So tell us the process and your decision to bring back the celebrated attorney Sandy Stern in this book.
You know, I can't exactly remember when I decided I was going to write from Stern's point of view again, because I do remember a kind of eureka moment as I was thinking about my next project, when I thought, and I had ideas about this book, and all of a sudden I thought, oh, you know, this is Sandy Stern's book. And Stern has never left the scene, as it were, in my imaginary Kindle County, because I write about the law and lawyers and legal cases. Sandy Stern is sort of the first citizen of Kindle County. He appeared first as Rusty Savage's defense lawyer in Presumed Innocent. He was the central figure in my second novel, The Burden of Proof. And he's appeared in major, or far more often minor, roles, sometimes mentioned only in a sentence in every succeeding novel. So he's never been far out of mind. But in 2010, I published a novel called Innocent, which was a sequel to Presumed Innocent. Sandy, for reasons I can't recall, you know, I don't know what motivated me to do this, but he had advanced cancer. Readers wrote me after reading the book and saying, please, please, Sandy Stern isn't going to die, is he? And I instinctively answered, no, he isn't. But when I wrote a paragraph about 3 or 4 years ago in my last novel, Testimony, that mentioned Sandy Stern being at a party, living in, quote, the alternate universe of cancer remission, I began saying to myself, wow, you know, this guy seems really fortunate to be alive for so long with stage 4 metastatic disease. What is he taking? What kind of therapy has he gotten? And that really was the genesis of the last trial, and the wonder drug Gilivia, which Stern is taking, and is one reason at the age of 85, he agrees to represent his old friend Kirill Pafko, because Stern literally owes Kirill his life.
So I know the title is The Last Trial, but is this the last time we're going to hear about Sandy Stern? Is there another case out there for him, perhaps?
I think Stern's children would tackle him and bind him hand and foot if he ever moved toward the courtroom again. I think once people have read The Last Trial, they'll understand why I say that. I don't think that it's the end of Stern's wisdom. So we may hear his voice again in talking to other characters, but at the age of 85, I once saw an 84-year-old trial lawyer at work, so I knew it was not physically impossible, but far beyond 85, I think that's a real task.
So I know you've talked about this a little bit, but did Sandy Stern come from somebody that you know, or was he in your imagination, or a combination of both?
Well, you have to understand, when I began writing Presumed Innocent, I was writing on the morning commuter train in these little 30-minute bits. And I thought I was getting somewhere. And my then agent called me up and said, you know, how are you? What are you working on? And I said, you know, well, I'm writing this novel about a prosecutor who's investigating the murder of his former lover. And she said, good, good, good. You know what about prosecutors? You are a prosecutor. And she paused for a minute and said, but there's a trial in that book, isn't there? And she was an intimidating presence in my life. I was afraid to say no. So I said, yes. And then I had to figure out who was on trial. And of course the answer eventually turned out to be Rusty himself. But if he was on trial, he needed a defense lawyer. And my parents had a friend who physically and in manner resembled Sandy Stern. He was a Cuban immigrant, not an Argentine immigrant. He was not a lawyer, but somehow I borrowed Alex's mannerisms because there was something about him that you could look across the room at this man and not think, there's no way this guy's gonna make a deep impression on me. But when he started speaking, when he came into your presence, there was something magical about him. And I thought, well, that would be a good trait to have as a defense lawyer as well.
Great character. Just loved him in the book. Let's talk a little bit about some of the other characters. We've talked a lot about Sandy. Judge Klonsky.
Sonny Klonsky made her first appearance in my fiction in The Burden of Proof, where she was Sandy's antagonist in an investigation of his brother-in-law. And they developed an affinity for each other that bordered on the romantic. And Sonny then gave up being a prosecutor and became a state court judge and was one of the two major figures in my fourth novel, The Laws of Our Fathers. And somewhere in passing in one of the other novels, I mentioned that she'd gone across the street and become a federal judge. So she's now the chief judge of the federal district court in the imaginary Kendall County. And I've always felt there were three characters I've written about who I felt closest to. One is Rusty Savage, another is Sandy Stern, and the third is Sonny Klonsky, whose sensibility about the law is one that I think I share. And she's always been a really neat person. And I continue to think of her that way. And, you know, whether she'll step forward in another novel, I can't tell you yet.
The prosecutor in all this, Moses Appleton.
Moses also made an appearance originally in The Burden of Proof. Ironically, Stern and his daughter, Marta, tried what proved to be Marta's first criminal defense case against Moses. And he was an incredible gentleman. And that has been his way of approaching things in the years since. He's now the U.S. attorney. He was the first assistant U.S. attorney for many years. He's an African-American, and he's that rarest of all birds, you know, an African-American Republican. But he's got a deep philosophy about the need for everyone to be responsible for and accountable to themselves. You know, he's also in this complicated world, which is not that unusual in a courthouse. He's also a close friend of Sonny Klonsky's. They were trial partners together when they were prosecutors. Everybody knows everybody really well.
I thought it was interesting as a reporter that covered the courts and City Hall, and you touched on this, and a lot of people may not know this, that, you know, the defense attorneys, the judges, the prosecutors, they all know one another. And sometimes they socialize together. And then you come into the courtroom and you all have these different roles. That's a tough balance sometimes. And I thought you wrote about that very well in this book.
It is not an unusual career path for somebody to start out as a prosecutor, become a defense lawyer, and then become a judge. So given that, you're bound to know people in all these different spheres and necessarily you're going to know if you're a judge, the lawyers who are pleading their cases before you. my friend Bill Bauer, who was the chief judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in Chicago, once said, if I don't know the difference between my business and my friends, then I shouldn't be sitting up here. And he was remarkably good about being objective without being hostile to his friends. But it's tough. I mean, I saw when I was a prosecutor, the U.S. attorney was a man named Thomas Sullivan, one of my great mentors. And his closest friend in the world was a judge named Prentice Marshall. And they tried cases together. They'd been law partners. And Prentice Marshall was a very tough judge on the government. And I remember Tom going up to Judge Marshall's courtroom and screaming at him, you know, with a courtroom full of spectators. You know, they both calmed down and laughed about it afterwards. But I'm not sure there's another profession where you can be so antagonistic with your close friends.
To me, a courtroom is such a great stage. It's really almost a field of play. Do you look at it this way? It's got a romantic sense to it.
I was sitting in a courtroom as a young prosecutor, and I'd always argued with people. I'd been a writing fellow at Stanford, and my view was that, you know, the best novel should be enjoyable for both an English professor and a bus driver. But figuring out what would capture a universal audience was not easy for me. And I was sitting in court, probably in my second year as a prosecutor, and the government's main witness was on the stand in what was a minor case. It was a food stamps case, but you couldn't hear a pin drop. Everybody was wrapped up in the story that this man was telling about how something that this community regarded as wrong or even evil, how it had happened. And it suddenly dawned on me, I looked at all of these people and thought, here it is. Here is the subject that will command a universal audience. The struggle between good and evil, the issues of to punish, and how harshly, making rules that are firm but flexible. Everything that goes on in a courtroom is inherently dramatic, and despite people's belief about how boring the law is, turns out to be appealing to a lot of so-called, you know, civilians. And certainly that's true with jury trials, because if the lawyers can't explain things that in terms that people off the street can understand, they're going to lose the case. So a trial by its nature bridges the divide between, you know, the priesthood of the law and regular folk.
Have you thought much about, and this kind of just popped into my head, is we're in the middle of this pandemic and trials will have to begin again, and there'll have to be juries, and they'll have to go deliberate, and we have to practice social distancing. That to me is going to be a bit of a challenge.
Well, you know, a lot of legal proceedings now are taking place remotely. The Supreme Court is hearing arguments by teleconference, something I thought I would never live to see. But the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution in a federal criminal case, and the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution has been, as the lawyers say, impressed against the states, meaning everybody's got to follow that rule. That talks about a criminal defendant's right to confront the witnesses against him. And I think by most rational interpretations, that means that the defendant gets the right to eyeball the witness against him across the courtroom. So it's going to be hard to conduct criminal trials that are not in person. Can we have social distancing in the jury box? Sure. I don't see any reason that we can't. We can even have social distancing among the courtroom spectators if they're willing to sit far enough apart. And Lord knows you're at great distance from the judge anyway. although a friend of mine wrote me a note recently about a courtroom in the suburban Chicago area, and it was a bail courtroom, and it was very cramped, very small, very crowded, no distancing of any kind, and the judge is at home now with COVID. So, but I still think it can be done, but you know, it's gonna slow stuff down.
Would Sandy Stern be as impressive or persuasive via telecom as seen him in person?
I don't think so. You know, Stern in Innocent, this novel that came out 10 years ago, was described by Rusty Savage's son as dumpy, that, you know, you would walk by him on the street and think nothing of him. But that when he stands up in the courtroom, it's like a beacon has been lit inside him. And, you know, personal presence makes a difference. And a lot of Stern's magic as a criminal lawyer comes from his personal presence.
Talk a little bit about the process of writing. Do you develop the story, then the characters? Just walk us through how you start to begin with an idea and start to write a book. What's your process like?
My process is a little strange. You know, I have friends that and sometimes when, you know, we'll talk about writing, and I can't understand how anybody else writes a book except the way I do it. But if I'm at the stage that I'm at right now, where I'm starting on a new book, I do not set any boundaries for myself. I will write anything down that comes into my mind about the situation that I'm thinking about. You know, about a young investigator, you know, where she's living, what she thinks of the takeout food that, you know, she ate last night, her personal life, you know, and of course, critical events in the action of the novel. But I could write about the Chinese food one day and, you know, the high point of the action the next. And a lot of it is still inside my head. And I don't know what I'm going to choose to get out. You know, my wife reminded me the other night about a mosquito that's going to be a critical part of the evidence. So, you know, someday I'll be writing about the mosquito. Once I've done that for about a year, then I kind of look at it, and this goes back to Presumed Innocent, which I was writing in the same way, these scraps that I was writing on the morning commuter train. And then I go, well, I got to put this mess together. And that's when the first coherent draft emerges. And, you know, that's when a complete lack of discipline about structure becomes quite disciplined. But until that part begins, it's, you know, not probably a great comparison, because I think he knew exactly where he was going. But Vladimir Nabokov wrote all his novels on index cards. And I don't think he necessarily wrote in order, which is why he had them on index cards. And I don't want to make any comparisons between myself and Nabokov, but it's the same kind of process.
So do you write in order, or do you go back and forth to different parts of the book, different chapters?
In that first year phase, I can be writing the end one day, or what I think might be the end. And then I'm back at the beginning the next, or in the middle. Or eventually, when you get scenes that you like, I start asking myself, okay, well, how did she get from here to there? What must have happened? And I have to figure out answers to the question.
So is it more difficult to write the end? Is that the most difficult part of this?
It really depends. One of the things I love about The Last Trial, I don't know if readers share my fondness for this, but the book actually seems to end three different times. And I, you know, that false ending was something that I found really amusing, because I knew that I was leading readers along. I don't recall when I knew the ultimate questions in terms of The Last Trial. Was Kirill innocent or guilty? It sure wasn't at the beginning. And there were substantial changes in the ending between the drafts. Now, the book I'm working on now, I was fooling around with it for about 3 months. And then all of a sudden I was hit with what I thought was the great twist in the next book. But I could just as well have worked on it for 2 years before figuring that out.
When you're done with a book, do you look back and say, is there a passage or a chapter that you say, I really like that. I really nailed that. That's exactly how I wanted to write that. And do you have a favorite chapter or scene in this book?
There are lots of scenes that I like. I had a wonderful time writing this book. And my wife has reminded me that I would, I wrote a lot of it down here in Florida. She says, and she reminded me that I was saying this, I would come out of my office and some days I would say, you know, it almost feels like I'm taking dictation. You know, the voice was so thoroughly known in the lives of the characters. So there are many passages I like, many parts of the book I like. I know my trial lawyer friends love a couple of the cross-examinations that occur closer to the end of the trial. But one of the things that happens early in the book is Stern has practiced law for 30 years with his daughter, Marta. And, you know, he is held on as a lawyer. And Marta comes to him shortly after he agrees to represent Kirill Pavko and says, Dad, I'm going to retire. And the idea of the 85-year-old who won't quit and his, you know, 55-year-old daughter, who's like a lot of lawyers after a few decades at it, just eager to do something else, that just tickled me. And that happened purely on a whim as I was doing this kind of exploratory writing that I was talking about before, Pat.
Well, I have to tell you, I loved the cross-examination of Innes McBee. I thought that was, I really enjoyed that chapter. I liked it a lot.
I enjoyed writing it. But as I like to tell people, they say, oh, that's such a brilliant cross-examination. And I say, you know, I've discovered that cross is a lot easier when you not only write the questions, but also the answers. You know, it's easy for the defense lawyer to look brilliant when you can make the witness look less brilliant.
That was Scott Turow talking with Patrick Livingston. Scott Turow's latest novel is The Last Trial. In the first half of the program, we heard from Terry McMillan talking with Rochelle Riley. Terry McMillan's latest book is It's Not All Downhill From Here. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Milcarrick.